This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody, it's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji. How are you today?
You know, some people say we should do as much as possible in the time remaining, but I've been slacking off, haven't done squat. I'm behind on chores, stay home a lot, eat and sleep as I feel, work on keeping it real. It's the end of the world. Why not?
You know, I think you've got something there.
I'm a big fan of the pursuit of acceptance, but despite what I claim customarily, I'm no master. I must admit, verily, that I'm far from a whiz. What I really mean is I'm just holding on temporarily. Hee-haw!
In my not-so-humble opinion, that's all any of us can do. I cringe every time I hear about another attempt to save the world. It seems like the harder we try, the worse things get. But I don't think all our geoengineering is up to controlling space weather, which is what this show is about.
How I learned to stop worrying and love the doom. I used to have worries and stress, which I never found ways to address. But we'll have no success in avoiding this mess, so lately I worry much less. Hee-haw!
That's the spirit. I can't even bring myself to follow the collapse news anymore. But when I heard about the M2 coronal mass ejection, or CME, on 14 July, Bastille Day, I thought it would be a stimulating change of pace to resurrect my interest in solar flares and CMEs from my days as a reporter of extreme weather events and turn our attention to the sun, especially with the total solar eclipse coming up in just a few weeks. Our featured guest for this show is Barry Snyder. With his wife Karen Anderson, he facilitates the inner work of soul awakening from a mystical and astrological paradigm. I like their guiding principle that the only way out is through, and the way their program is set up as a self-directed at-home course with their support available on an as-needed basis. You can find out more about this work at luminousself.com. But for the purpose of exploring solar science, I was more interested in Barry's knowledge about the interaction between the sun's radiation and the Earth's electromagnetic cycles. So, here we are on Saturday, the 22nd of July, and I'm speaking with Barry Snyder, who was referred to me by our own Elizabeth West as someone who could speak about solar science and the health of our closest star from whom we derive our life itself, plants need our sun in order to grow, and we need plants in order to feed ourselves. So there's kind of a closed loop there. We recently experienced a solar flare / coronal mass ejection last weekend, as a matter of fact. And I guess most of the impact from that was felt in Australia rather than on this side of the planet. So we'll get into the impact in a minute. What I want to talk about first, Barry, is to get back to the basics and explain to our listeners what is a solar flare versus a coronal mass ejection. Is the one the visual impression and the other one is the result?
No, they're two different things. Sunspots are positively and negatively polarized. And when there's enough of a field strength in that polarization, what will happen is there'll be a leap of charge from one to the other to try to negate the charge. And that creates a flaring, and that's a solar flare. Right? It creates a stream of particles that go out into space. The corona is the hot gas envelope that's around the sun. A coronal mass ejection, what happens is literally a big bubble escapes the magnetic field of the sun and goes out into space as this massive front of charged particles and material that is like a shock wave almost that goes through the solar system. And they're usually the biggest issue for the Earth. When a CME comes, it'll come into the Earth's magnetic field. And the magnetic field of the Earth is kind of like our womb. Radiation from space will impact the magnetic field and compress it. And the Earth is designed to mitigate that so that it's not a critical impact to life on the planet.
How can that be? How can the Earth mitigate something that's so strong it escaped the sun's magnetic field? The Earth's magnetic field is stronger than that of the sun?
No, it's not. But by the time it gets here
and goes
through 93 million miles of space,
it diffuses some. Is that?
Think of it, you drop a rock in a pond. The further out that goes, the wave front becomes smaller and more diffused.
Okay.
So that's why. Mm-hmm. So life is built to work, you know, for the most part. And, you know, there's cyclical things where there's breakdowns in that process, which are also, I think, part of the life-death-life cycle. But as stasis goes, the planet is designed to handle most of what the sun brings its way. Now, it does cause changes on the planet. It ionizes the upper atmosphere. For instance, the aurora borealis is just this. It's the energy from the sun is received. And because the way the magnetic field is constructed over the poles, it actually tends to be the weakest. The magnetic field originates and then terminates at the poles. It literally spirals out of the south magnetic pole, spirals around and goes into the north.
A torus.
Exactly, as a torus. That's the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why we see the auroras is that energy will go in to that imploding vortex at the North Pole, and it allows all that energy to go in there, and then we get those brilliant auroras that are over the extreme Arctic areas headed south.
So this flare that we had, or this CME that we had last weekend, was considered moderate in strength, and yet it seems that it's having a much greater impact than, let's say, the very strong one that happened, I can't remember, 18-something or other. They had a really powerful one.
The Carrington event.
Yeah, that one. But they weren't as dependent back then on the electrical grid and, of course, the internet.
Yeah.
And as dependent as we are on these things that these events disrupt, and as weak as our magnetic protection is becoming, I'm worried about the future of our... Benji, help me out here.
You know, someday the whole grid will fail, and there won't be a way to derail the meltdown heat which will leave no retreat to continue the human tale. For plants still in operation, unexpected electric cessation of short duration could cause activation of radioactive damnation. Each abandoned reactor, no doubt, eventually will start to spout stuff which can spread and make people dead once electric power runs out.
We keep saying this in the climate science world that, you know, sustainability isn't about sustaining industrial civilization, but at the end of the day, it really is, because we are industrialized humans.
Yeehaw!
It's like Benji said, so-called free, sustainable, renewable energy still depends on a grid to deliver it to cool those 440-something nuke plants and the thousands of waste pools where lie the spent fuel rods.
Absolutely, and I, this is my personal viewpoint, okay? I think everything is pointing us to the fact that this world, this industrial world that we've created with this incredible complexity that requires such immense input of resources as to be unsustainable. We're headed to a Seneca cliff one way or another with what we're doing here on this planet. And I think that what the sun is doing is, you know, maybe life through what may happen here with the sun and the geomagnetic field of the earth is really a form of rebalancing that's going to happen as, you know, the great mother of all working things out for us, helping us maybe to rebalance ourselves when we're really out of control as a species. Personal opinion, but coming down to the facts of it, your point is really well made. And that is the Carrington event, which occurred in the 1850s, when the only communication we had was the telegraph system. Richard Carrington actually was observing the sun, and he saw this thing being released from the sun. And I guess he observed what was happening as this wave of energy coming to the earth, towards the earth. Well, when it hit, it induced so much electrical energy into the planetary grid matrix that all these telegraph lines all over the planet inducted that, like a lightning rod, so to speak. They inducted that energy and ran it through the telegraph system and literally fried the lines, shocked operators, and basically almost took down the telegraph grid, which was very crude compared to what we have today in terms of its sophistication, complexity, its ability to withstand that sort of thing. Because now we have microelectronics, which is another whole story. Your other point is really well made too. That happened before another phenomenon is occurring, and that is the loss of field strength in nearest magnetic field. And that has been happening since the 1800s, and it's rapidly accelerating. So, as we mentioned earlier, the Earth's magnetic field is our protective womb. It's what keeps us protected from the bombardment of energy from space. As it becomes less in field strength, it means more of that gets through. From the 1800 to 2000, it dropped 10%. So we were at 90% over that 200-year period. Then in the last 10 years, from 2000 to 2010, it dropped another 5%. The European Space Agency did a study and they found, yes, in fact, the field strength is still dropping. They didn't give a percentage. Coincidental with that, and this is really important, is that the Earth's poles are also migrating, and they are migrating also at an accelerating rate, sort of in alignment with the acceleration in the drop of the field. Now, that has all the earmarks of a magnetic reversal. It's happened before, but that's what happens. The poles start to move, and they shift from their existing location. It was before, it was up sort of above Canada, and now it's over the North Pole headed to Siberia. The South Pole is moving more slowly, but it looks like the models actually show these poles on a 90% flip, Indian Ocean, North Pole, and South Pole, I believe, somewhere in Latin America, is what some of the models are showing. It's a 90% pole flip. But what happens is that when the field strength drops to a certain point, the poles shift. And when that happens, there's a drastic accelerating drop in field strength. It could be down to 10%, 20%, 30%. Now, when that happens, the Earth is basically unprotected.
Vulnerable, yeah.
We're basically unprotected.
Not to mention the pole shift itself is going to create all kinds of chaos. I mean, you know, your compass doesn't point to the same place anymore.
Oh, navigation. Think about navigation. Airplanes, there's already been some adjustments with that. And we don't really, really know the full impact of a magnetic reversal. We simply do not. We haven't lived through one. Scientists speculate. But what I've learned is that what we know is significantly less than what we don't know.
Yeah.
And we're probably going to find out a lot because it looks like this will happen in our lifetime. An excellent website, magneticreversal.org. There's a wealth of information on here about this.
I'm interrupting this interview to bring you supplementary information from the magneticreversal.org website. Actually, it's a single web page with a few embedded images and video clips and the following 9 fast facts, each of which is in turn a link to the supporting documentation. 1. The South Pole has already left Antarctica, and the North Pole is racing across the Arctic Ocean. 2. Earth's magnetic poles are getting ready to flip, according to the mission manager of SWARM. 3. The magnetic field began weakening in 1600. 4. The magnetic field weakened 10% from the 1800s to 2000. 5. Earth's magnetic field was weakening 5% per century, but now is weakening 5% per decade. 6. As of 2014, the magnetic field is continuing to weaken rapidly. 7. Magnetic reversals can occur in less than 100 years. 8. Magnetic reversals lead to extinction events. 9. Magnetic reversals may cause biblical floods. Okay, back to you, Barry.
One of the really interesting graphics does an extrapolation of the drop in field strength over time. And it's an animation, so you can see it. It's very powerful. But if you take the deltas on the drop of field strength from the 1800 to 2000 period, then you take the next delta from 2000 to 2010, and if you project that geometric curve, and this is, again, it's one of the things that I think human beings have the most difficult time with, and that is understanding logarithmic or exponential functions.
Oh, yeah. We see that in climate science as well.
I never forget when I was in college, we had a professor of geoscience said, don't worry about all these other things that might be a problem for humanity. The biggest problem for humanity is in humanity's mind, and that is the linear concrete mind has a very difficult time understanding exponential functions. And it's probably our inability to understand that is causing us not to be able to respond to what's really happening fast enough.
It's become a joke, this whole faster than predicted tagline.
Yeah.
You know, the effects are not linear, they're not additive, they're exponential and multiplicative. My academic background is in psycholinguistics, and I think so much of this is tied up in the fact that language itself is linear. We can only say one word at a time, you know?
Good point.
And,
really good
you know,
point.
When people get excited and they start interrupting each other, that's an attempt to make it exponential, the conversation go exponential, and it can't happen.
Yeah.
There gets confusion, emotions get raw and ragged, and the communication falls apart. Because we're just not wired for alignment with exponentiality, if you will.
Yeah, you know, and I think there's probably good reasons for that. And that is that the way the body is constructed physiologically, emotionally, psychically, and living systems themselves have a fairly small bandwidth of adaptability. And if you start punching against the bounds of that adaptability, there's necessary, like in a psychological level, when you get to that, you know, that's why people go into denial. That's why they shut down, because they're going outside of what they can integrate psychologically. It's an adaptive mechanism, but it's also potentially a fatal mechanism when we're confronted with what we're confronted with climatologically, and now with space science is telling us.
And that's why I have to question the notion of rebalancing humanity. I'm not sure it's humanity that's being rebalanced. I think it's life itself that's being rebalanced. I'm coming over to the view of humanity as basically close but no cigar, you know, a failed experiment, so to speak, on the part of life itself.
That is very, you know, I've looked at all different sides of this, and I certainly understand that viewpoint, and it's easily argued as a fact that we are a failed experiment. I think the other viewpoint, I'd like to just mention Barbara Marx Hubbard. She's been with us since the 30s, still on the planet, and was one of the real first futurists that was really cutting edge to really explore what's going on this planet and where are we headed. And she came to the conclusion that humanity is in the greatest evolutionary leap possibility. And she says it could be a stillbirth. She's used that term, stillbirth, that this could be a failed experiment. We may not birth this. But the point that she makes is a point that's a fact. And that is, if you look at, we look at evolution on this planet, what we see is a progression of unfolding species, the phylogenic tree, that moves always towards greater complexity and sophistication. That's a fact. It's gone that way till we get to Homo sapiens sapiens, who are the most complex, the most sophisticated, and have the most consciousness of anything on that, in that whole chain.
You know, I don't like a science which clings to what anthropocentrism brings. I'd rather a model not based on the twaddle that man is the measure of things. Hee-haw!
You familiar with Derek Jensen? He's the author of a book called The Myth of Human Supremacy.
Very much, Derek. I know Derek very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to invoke that body of knowledge in response to what you just said about Homo sapiens sapien being at the peak of the evolutionary tree, because I'm not sure that there's not some aquatic species, just because we don't have the sensory apparatus to communicate with them. I'm not sure that we're at any higher level of consciousness than whales, for example.
I would agree. I think there's a very big question about dolphins, for instance, they have larger development of the frontal eminences of the brain than we do. So I would,
it's been a phrase, size isn't everything.
That's true.
I mean, they've done studies about the percentage of body mass that's occupied by brain, and there's no correlation with consciousness or complexity or anything like that and brain size or brain proportion anywhere in the family tree of life. So
yeah.
What that says to me is that we don't know, and we're too consumed by hubris to admit that we don't know.
Captain's Log, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Here lies the species humanity. Did they die from some kind of insanity? All their ability yielded futility. Vanity, all is just vanity. Hee-haw!
I think it's always a good foundation to go back to humility. I completely agree with you.
And as far as Barbara and the birth of a new humanity and all that, when I was working with the Shift Network back in 2012, she would talk about the internet as being the nervous system of the new human. And, well, I'm sorry, but if we're going to lose our internet, then it is going to be a stillbirth or at least a crib death.
Unless it becomes an internet, I-N-N-E-R, net. That leads me back to when I lived in the islands.
Which islands?
Hawaii. I lived on Kauai for years. And the kahunas would always often tell these stories about how we had lost so many of our abilities as a species, and that there was a time when one group of people on one island or on the other side of an island were having a trouble. The people on the other side of the island would know this somehow, okay? They would understand this. They would get a message somehow internally and go over to help them. Hmm. So that we were much more, there were other dimensions of consciousness that maybe we've atrophied or lost even, that were evident there. And the kahunas just swear by that, you know, that's a fact. And of course, many shamans have demonstrated that there are these other levels of consciousness. What's happened throughout history, evolution, the history of this planet, go back to the very beginning, like 3.5 billion years ago with the prokaryotes, which were the single-celled organisms that had no organelles. I mean, you talk about basic life form. Mm-hmm. They just floated around in the ocean, and if something floated by that they could ingest, that's how they kept going. And they proliferated to such a degree that they were facing at least a mass die-off because they were reaching the limits of their system to support them.
Yeah.
And just at the moment when that was going to happen, all of a sudden, one of those prokaryotes called the cyanobacteria learned how to do photosynthesis. Now, photosynthesis wasn't a concept. You know, there was no predecessor for photosynthesis. There was no ancillary possibility of photosynthesis in that ecosystem. If scientists would have been alive and walking the planet then, we have today, and looked at the state of the prokaryotes, they would have said, doomed, done, history, there's going to be a massive die-off, this is going to be bad news. Where did photosynthesis come from? How all of a sudden did, in the cell walls of those simple organisms, did something happen that they learned to trap sunlight, go through a biochemical process that produced energy that allowed them all of a sudden to take this quantum leap in their capacity as a species?
Well, you keep saying all of a sudden, but I wonder how many generations of those prokaryotic cells had to go through the die-off process in order for those few who mastered this photosynthetic technique to emerge.
Good question.
And flourish.
We don't know. It's probably a long way. You know, getting into this discussion, just a little bit of cursory research I've done. Robert Felix did a book called Magnetic Reversals and Evolutionary Leaps. He makes a point in there, and that is this whole idea of missing links. Maybe there really aren't any missing links, because this idea of natural selection, you know, the Darwinian idea that nature just keeps trying stuff, and then it gets stuff that work and stuff that doesn't work, and then the stuff that doesn't work automatically gets eliminated because it's not functional, not survivable. But he points out, like, from the point where creatures had just fins to the point where they had legs that they could become amphibious, postulating tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years between the two. Well, when you're halfway between a fin and a leg, you aren't going to cut it on this planet. You're not good in the ocean and you're worthless on the land. How does that work out in Darwin's theory of evolution? I really want to take a look at this and do some research. It makes a big question of mine in this little Homo sapiens sapiens mind of what is going on there with this whole idea of missing links and things like that, and the whole issue of intelligent design and evolution. And I think it's always a both and. And my research has always shown it's some integration of those two, which we have not yet gotten aware enough to understand how they both interplay into some larger picture.
Right, because we're stuck in that either-or paradigm where, yeah, with the emergence of science, then other ways of knowing had to be side-railed, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm totally in agreement with you there. It's that exact both-and integration that needs to happen. I don't understand the resistance to that. There's been discussion of the reconciliation and integration of science and spirituality for a couple or three decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand where this resistance is still coming from. Maybe that's yet another gift that the Trump administration has for us, is to put science back in its place and give more precedence to other ways of knowing, even if the information isn't as palatable to us as we might like.
Yeah.
The fact that science is no longer has godhood qualities might be a good thing. It might be just what we need.
Well, I think it does, because I don't even think it's science. When you look at science, as science presents itself, it's not really doing the scientific process. It's not using scientific methodology.
Oh, well, that's because scientists are owned. That's because money has gotten mixed up in it. I'm talking about real science. I'm not talking about commercial science.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even commercial science, from my perspective, I was a chemistry major, and the reason was I had this chemistry teacher I just loved, and he was a real life, the scientific method. And it starts with observation and hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you must include all the observable phenomena in the field before you make a hypothesis. So if you throw out observable data, then you're already off on the wrong foot. Science limits its observable data to things that it can test and experience rigorously on a materialistic third-dimensional level with the instruments of that nature. So it takes things that are psychic, spiritual in nature, which are equally observable phenomena, and discounts them and removes them from the picture. Thereby, you're stuck with a limited third-dimensional model, which, given what we know about science today and quantum theory, for instance, superstring theory, to even work, you have to have 10 dimensions of reality for it to even work.
Mm-hmm.
So even our science is banging up against this thing of saying, you know what? The bubble we're working in here doesn't work even when we put rigorous mathematical models to describe these things. It says we need a bigger field to play in, more dimensions to play in. So I think we're on a collision course where we're going to pop our bubble one way or another in science and spirituality. Look at the Vedas. The Rishis, we don't know how long ago they existed in India. They produced infinitely complex, detailed diagrams of the human body without ever opening it up and taking it apart. How did they do that? How did the Mayans get this incredibly advanced understanding of time and cosmology without ever having satellites and huge telescopes they could launch out into space? They understood it better than we did. How did they do that? What I say is, if you're a scientist, you have to look at that and go, there is observed data that if I do not integrate into a hypothesis, my theory has to be wrong. So keep getting our bubble bigger and bigger. Hopefully this isn't a digression with what we're talking about here, but
it is, and I'm loving it.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
I believe it's the failure of science to take observable data into account that results in the classic paradoxes of the world we have come to take on faith. For example, more than 10 years ago, I heard a scientist admit that it is impossible to give a scientific reason for the fact that most of us, at least, can't remember the future as readily as we can the past. Maybe that kind of prescience is one of those lost faculties your kahunas were talking about. Or maybe there's something wrong with those fundamental postulates of mathematics and physics. Tim Blay saw clear empirical evidence of the paradox of the one-way arrow of entropy. Tim is a physicist and a very accomplished musician who publishes on a YouTube channel, too, actually, called Acapella Science. Listen with me now to Entropic Time, a parody of Billy Joel's The Longest Time, and consider subscribing to this body of work on YouTube and or supporting Tim on Patreon.
Do, do, do. Whoa, arrow entropic of entropic time. Whoa, arrow entropic of entropic. If you made a scramble, and when it's fried, you can turn it back to raw food. That is the arrow of entropic time. Structure decomposes till it's gone. Hot spots cool and entropy grows on. Stars explode and leaves turn brown and fall. That's thermodynamics' second law. But from a deep view, that doesn't need to be true. Time symmetry precludes entropic time. Maybe this won't last very long. Cosmos is in that case, it's probable we are a brain without a jar, decomposed in a moment. Who knows if that's true and I'll be gone. Thermalize before you hear this song. I'll take my chances. Place that then dispersed. Anthropic Time. Whoa, Arrow of Anthropic Time. Whoa, Arrow of Anthropic Time. Whoa, Arrow of Anthropic Time.
That was Anthropic Time by Tim Blay. More of his work can be found on the Acapella Science YouTube channels, and I've posted the lyrics to this particular song on the Panina page for this show. So, Barry, have you had any news from Australia? I saw one item where they were saying that there was a flash in the sky, and they lost radio, internet, television, all kinds of communication signals.
Yes.
But it was only a momentary thing. But, you know, in spite of the fact that this was only supposed to be moderately intense CME, it was of longer duration than such a moderately intense CME had any business being.
Yes, you know, Susan, again, what we know and what we don't know is really in our face here again. The sun going into this minimum, the sun is quieting down. It's quieting down. The number of flares has gotten less and less. And that's a longer cycle too. There appears that there's about a 400 year cycle for total solar activity. Let's call that CMEs and solar flares. The last was the Maunder minimum in the 1640s to 1700, where the sun goes into a quiet phase, just like it's a corollary on a longer term cycle of the 11 year sunspot cycle. So we should be entering into that again right now. We don't know how low it'll go. And there's all these other phenomena happening, like these longer term CMEs. There's things that are happening on the sun. Coronal holes. Coronal holes are basically an opening in the envelope of hot plasma gas envelope around the sun that allow you to look into the sun. And what happens is that when those coronal holes open up, there's a stream of charged particles called the solar wind that just come to the Earth, and they can cause disruptions too. Well, coronal holes used to be pretty much limited to the poles. There's huge coronal holes now equatorially on the sun. What is that about? There's a whole lot more going on here, again, than we really understand. And the disruptions are happening, like you're saying, in Australia. There's one I remember off the top of my head. In 2015 in Sweden, there was a flare. I think it was an M-class flare that basically grounded all aircraft in Sweden for about 2 or 3 hours because their radar wouldn't work.
Wow.
There's probably some cyclical process in the sun's internal energy generation. There's more available energy in the environment, you know, for a particular period of time of 11-year cycles with sunspot, but there's also longer cycles, one of which we know is a 400-year cycle. And it's a corollary to the 11-year cycle. And when that happens, these sunspots can go down to very, very minimal. During the Maunder minimum, you know, there were no X-class flares, very few M-class flares. And that's magnitude. That's all we're talking about is magnitude. And there were orders of 10, log 10. So X is the highest level. You have X1 through X10. You have M1 through M10. You know, so during the Maunder minimum, I don't think there were any X-class and maybe very few lower order M-class flares. Now, interestingly enough, we have had no X-class flares for the last number of years, and we're having fewer M-class flares of a lower order. And the M-class flares are now having a much bigger impact
vulnerable and weakened conditions.
Exactly. This is the key point. And we're at the bottom of the 11-year cycle. So the longer-term cycle is in effect. We don't know how low it's going to go. It may not go as low as the Maunder minimum. We have no way of knowing that. It could start back up. It could be like there was a Dalton minimum. Dalton minimum was in the 1800s, if my memory serves me, actually. It did the same dip, but it didn't go nearly as low. So we don't know. But it's going to go back up if we are in a reversal process, which right now, there's a very good reason to believe that that's the case, based upon the acceleration in the drop of the field and the movement of the poles that's accelerating exponentially. I did the math myself. And if you extrapolate the curve, it's sometime before 2030 that we should have a reversal. Now, interestingly enough, the whole scientific paradigm was long time for reversals, hundreds of thousands of years. Well, a few years ago, a team at Berkeley came out with a vetted, peer-reviewed paper that shows not so. It's not always that way. They can happen in less than 100 years, possibly much shorter.
And it's already been happening for about 80 or 100 years, right?
Yeah.
So now I'm going to share 5 truths about magnetic pole reversal by Suspicious Observer, another of the sources you recommended. 1. Earth's magnetic poles are reversing at an exponential rate, according to a 2003 NASA report. 2. Earth's magnetosphere is declining in field strength at an exponential rate, from 10% per century to 15% per decade, according to swarm data. There are stronger fields in northern Canada, in Siberia, and at the southern magnetic pole. The weakest field is found at the so-called South Atlantic Anomaly, the likely new site of magnetic north. 3. The poles are moving toward each other from Siberia and southeastern Australia. At the South Bali buoy, a seafloor rise of thousands of feet was observed, measured, and recorded. Directly opposite is that site between the South Atlantic Anomaly and the highly anomalous Bermuda Triangle. 4. Magnetic reversals correspond with extinction events due to atmosphere loss, according to a paper in Earth and Planetary Science Letters by Yong Wei et al. In May 2014. Details and documentation are available on a short YouTube video by Suspicious Observer called Superflood. 5. The reversal may come sooner than expected, according to a team of scientists from Italy, France, and the U.S. at Columbia and UC Berkeley. They published findings in October 2014 that it can happen within as little as 80 years, and the current reversal started a century ago. This is jaw-dropping information, Barry.
I think we're waking up to what's coming. No, not what's coming, what's happening. So if this is exponential, like climate change is, like it's becoming obvious, isn't it interesting when you hear people like Guy McPherson and others, now Wadhams and other people are coming in, this whole day of the 2020-2030 being where we could really hit the wall is now where it looks like magnetic reversal. We could hit the wall.
I was thinking that very thought, that 2030 date is starting to sound much more familiar.
Yeah.
I want to point also to the fact that just like with climate change, it's not a matter of on December 31st, 2029 at midnight, everybody needs to duck and cover. You know, that's not how it works. We're on our way now.
Yeah.
We've been on our way for quite some time, apparently.
And it's already getting more intense. I've noticed this myself. I remember as a kid, we go out and lay out, and the sun was more yellow in color. I don't know if you remember that, but I've talked to many people that are my age, you know, and they say, yeah, the sun was more yellow. I've been working at a fire lookout in the summers for almost over, a little over 2.5 decades. And I used to go out and sit outside in the sun in the afternoon for periods of time. I go out there now, and the sun stings my body. There's more UVB and things getting through because the magnetic field is dropping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other people I'm talking to are going, you're right, the sun is more intense. It feels like it stings my skin now. And that is a symptom of the magnetic field declining.
And the Earth generation of electromagnetic pollution is increasing.
That's another factor, huge factor.
Electrical field sensitivity that people are coming up with. It's very related to something that I live with, which is called multiple chemical sensitivity.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the amount of dirty electricity that's just in the environment. It's invisible and it's ubiquitous and it's very insidious in its effects. It's not like it's going to make you vomit or cause you to start bleeding or pass out or something like that. It's a very insidious kind of effect.
I'm your coal mine canary for that. I can literally feel it. It feels like steel wool white noise that starts in my head and it builds up. And it feels like circuits start to shut down in my body and my brain. There's too much electromagnetic energy coming into my system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sensitive. I've played this with my wife. We'll be driving down the road, and I'll say, I'm going to close my eyes, And I'm going to tell you when we're getting near a cell tower.
Mm-hmm.
And I can close my eyes and I can say, I can feel it now. And I'm dead on every time because I'm just so sensitive to that. You know, my take on it is that it affects our neurological system. It even affects us genetically.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many of the things, all the ADHD and stuff, I mean, sure, there's all the chemicals and food additives and everything else, but I mean, all this exposure to ionizing radiation, including microwaves, is cumulative. You don't slough it off over a lifetime. It builds up in your system.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing to ourselves? Is this going to be, I mean, what lead pipes were to the Romans? I wonder if this is the
magnetic radiation in your world and petrochemicals in mine. And those
yeah.
are the two biggest addictions that industrial mm-hmm. civilization is subject to, petrochemicals and the grid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to give you some advice about depression, okay? Don't be depressed and in doubt. Keep your head held up high and don't pout. Soldier on, do it now. I'll let you know how as soon as I figure it out. Hee-haw!
I don't see a satisfactory way to fix it. I think the very act of fixing it generates more of the same.
Anybody that does some deep research in it realizes that there's no way out from a human perspective of what the resources we have. Technology isn't going to do it, and technology never would really do it because it requires the idea of exponential growth, continued growth on a finite planet has never made sense.
I think that the part that the Doomer community is on about is that as we hit that wall, our 440 some odd nuclear plants go unattended.
I know, that's when Guy made that point a number of years ago, I was like, that was a jaw dropper for me. I hadn't really thought about that, what would happen and what it takes. I mean, even with Fukushima to decommission that, they're saying, what, 50 to 100 years? And how many countless trillions? I mean, the amount of money is just unfathomable to do
it. Beyond the time and money, willingness.
Exactly.
You know, people want their creature comforts. And they're willing to take any manner of risk if there's the tiniest chance that it can be done safely, then they'll take the chance regardless of the enormous odds.
It's obvious. All you have to do is open your eyes. You can see it. It's the nature of human consciousness in its current state.
And why not? It's not just humans. You know, even the cells on the petri dish are going to
be
guilty of overshoot. You know, it's what life does. They don't call it a biological imperative for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
What part of imperative do we not yet understand? You know, all life forms go into overshoot. That's why most of them, all of them except Homo sapiens sapiens, have effective predators and are engaged in a web that keeps their, you know, the population expands and contracts in a cyclical manner. And somehow humans have divorced themselves from that cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the microbes will catch up with us. We've got the cholera, we've got the Zika, we've got all those kind of things that will eventually.
Epitaph. Here lie the humans now through. They just did what animals do ever since their debut. Not too much in review. Get born and die, eat shit and screw. Hee-haw!
I'm going to hold the other possibility, which is a possibility we can't deny. It could be the end of the human species. We definitely could. Nobody won't argue against that. But it could also be where some evolutionary adaptation or leap happens, like happened with the cyanobacteria. You know, things have happened. There can be a leap. We don't know. I and some people have to keep our minds open that there could be some leap that we could. None of those leaps were foreseeable. It was impossible from the existing matrix to foretell that, but they happened. So we cannot know that it cannot happen again. It can. And I'm with you. We have to act with what we have here right now and respond to that, which is we are all in the sixth great extinction. There's no question about that. We have to face the fact that this species, as it is terminal. Whether another one will emerge, we do not know, but this species is terminal.
Probably this genus and maybe even this whole order.
Yeah.
You know, the luminous being of the 10,000 year out future is going
yeah.
be anaerobic, not so dependent on water, and immune to ionizing radiation.
Yeah.
Because this species has had it. Our power plants will outlive us by a long, 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 long time, thousands and even tens of thousands of years. They'll be around long after we're gone.
Yeah.
So whoever is going to be that next leap is going to have to be immune to that stuff.
Yeah, and or have developed the capacity to understand how to basically neutralize things like that. And I suspect if there is any reality to the fact that there are extraterrestrials, they have developed scientific understandings that far transcend what we do.
Some of the fungi already know how to do that.
Well, that's and you know what? They're in the Gulf of Mexico, all the stuff from Deepwater Horizon, they go, where's that oil going? Microbes and bacteria have showed up that are gobbling that stuff up. Mother Nature produced it on her own.
Well, she had no choice because
the
seafloor killed all the plankton. All the vertebrates are gone completely. So we got to start over with the bacteria. And life is amazingly tenacious, but complex life is too fragile.
As Tim Blay so disarmingly illustrated in song just moments ago,
you can't put it back together again. Once you've broken the egg open, you're not going to get it back into the shell. You know, you're going to end up with something entirely different, like a fried egg. So that's what's going on in the Gulf.
And let's just finish it up with one thing, and that is, let's look at the end of this end game on the magnetic field decline.
Yep.
Because I think this is really what I'd want to include at the end of this. What happens as the magnetic field drops down to 70, 60, 50, 40, 30? Well, what happens is we're bombarded with radiation. And what does that mean? It means cancer is going to go on an exponential upward curve for people. Probably neurological problems. You know, central nervous system is highly, highly sensitive to electromagnetics.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about a species that's increasingly degraded, cancerous, and probably not psychologically balanced. You're going to see more and more psychological imbalance. You're going to see more and more bizarre, aberrant behavior, more dysfunction psychologically, emotionally. This is going to affect other species. It's not just us. It's going to affect, like you say, all the mammals. We're going to know if this is happening because it's going to be everywhere. We're going to see this. We're also going to see, like what's happened in Australia and happened in Sweden in 2015, it's going to start to affect air travel. It's going to affect communications, satellites. The Carrington Big CMA did not happen at a time of maximum solar activity. It happened at a minimum. You can get a massive solar flare or a CME, even doing a Maunder minimum, or 11-year cycle minimum. So when we get down to 40, 50%, if we get an X-class flare, we're toast. Basically, there's microprocessors in everything. It would take down the internet. This computer wouldn't work. Basically, we go from modern, industrial, complex society to hunters and gatherers like that. That's what happens. Nothing works. Nothing works. So anyhow, that's what may lie in front of us less than 15 years.
Or 15 days, for that matter. You just
could, yeah. We don't know. It could be any time.
It makes Y2K look like a...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I hope that gives you a little bit of a sense of my knowledge of what's going on space weather-wise as it affects the sun and this planet for the potentially foreseeable future. And all the listeners can simply start observing what's going on with solar activity, what's going on in this planet, looking for disruptions in communication, air travel, and it will speak for itself.
Yeah, because the media certainly isn't going to cover it.
Probably not.
Very obvious. Like I said, they don't want to spook the herd.
No.
So, okay. Well, Barry, I want to thank you for taking this time to meet with me and sort out some of these confused and tangled threads of this incredibly complex web. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome, Susan. We're going to be all sorting these threads out very intensely, I think, more intensely every day over the next period of time.
I was a biology minor. I was a psychology major.
So this is kind of a steep learning curve for me.
Hats off to you. It's complex stuff, and it's mind-boggling, and it's emotionally difficult to look at it all. Thank you, Susan. Have a good one.
Bye now.
Bye.
You know, I used to be a prepper, as if preps would help. Myopic as some mental midget, I stocked both essential and widget. But when doom does hit, my preps won't mean shit. I feel like a fucking idiot. Hee-haw!
Thank you for your sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary. And a special thanks to my featured guest, Barry Snyder, for a stimulating conversation on short notice. To musical guest Tim Blay for his a cappella science lessons. And to Zimft for the sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Through